No risk it, no biscuit.
Coming from the Arizona desert, presented by SBNation.com. For Arizona Cardinals fans, by Arizona Cardinals fans, with outsider and insider's perspective, this is Revenge of the Birds. Good evening, Arizona Cardinals fans. This is Revenge of the Birds Radio. I'm your host, Jess Root, welcoming you on a Tuesday night. And unfortunately, like past couple of Tuesday nights that we've been on, it does not follow an Arizona Cardinals victory. However, we have a double show in store for you guys tonight. As normally Tuesday night happens to be when we bring on Seth and Ben from RevengeOfTheBirds.com, and we talk about the game that passed. We'll be talking about the Niners game. We'll still do that. We're going to have Seth Cox coming on a little bit later tonight. As soon as he gets on, we will have him join us. We also have, as a bonus tonight, as the Cardinals are on a short week, rather than waiting until Thursday night to do our preview show, that would be a little bit late. Because on Thursday night, the Arizona Cardinals will be hosting the Seattle Seahawks at home as the National Thursday Night Football game. So we're working on a truncated schedule, so we're doing, instead of two shows this week, we are doing one, two in one. Yes, that's right, you're getting two for the price of one. And it still might not be worth your price, right? Even though you didn't pay anything. But we're going to be talking about the Seattle Seahawks. We're going to be talking about the game coming up on Thursday. And we're going to talk about the game going past. In fact, we have joining us on the line, we have Scott Enyart coming on from Field Goals, the other SB Nation site that we will be using tonight, and that is fieldgoals.com from SB Nation, our Seattle Seahawks blog. And we're going to bring Scott on, and I believe got him on the line. Scott, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Glad to have you. Thanks for taking a few minutes out of your evening to talk Seattle Seahawks and Arizona Cardinals football. So first off, how great is it right now to be a Seattle Seahawks fan?
Well, it depends on who you ask, really. I mean, the majority of them are pretty happy with being 5-1, but there's a growing group of grumblers who, don't like the sloppy win in Houston, don't like the sloppy win versus Tennessee, and I think we're getting a little bit spoiled, but for those of us who have suffered through some lean years, it's pretty good right now.
So, Scott, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came about to Field Goals in SB Nation.
Well, I was down at SC when Coach Carroll was and Sark and all kind of the Seattle guys that run all the programs up here were at SC. And so when they all took jobs up here, I was working in media at the time covering college football, and like I said, I was also working at USC for part of that time. And so I guess I kind of became a resident expert for a lot of stuff in the early Carroll years just because, his philosophy and his approach was so different. And so that's how I got involved with Field Goals, is Danny Kelly, who runs the site, had me do kind of a lot of just introspective pieces on Carroll and how he wanted to build and just kind of his approach and stuff like that. And I coached college football as well, so did a little bit of X's and O's stuff and just kind of helped those guys in that regard. And, so it's got a little bit of everything that led me there, and just help out however I can.
Well, great. Again, I appreciate you taking some time tonight as we've got the early game. How do you feel about Thursday Night Football first off? Overall, it's great to have football Thursday night, Saturday if you follow college, Sunday and Monday. However, there tends to be a pocket of fans that doesn't really like the idea of Thursday night football. What camp do you fall into?
Generally speaking, I like it. If you play fantasy football, it's a bit of a pain just because you kind of got to do some roster moves earlier in the week, and you got to be on your game Monday, Tuesday if you have those 2-day waiver wires. You got to get guys playing by then. You know, on Thursday, I enjoy college football on Thursday nights. So now I'm kind of in a position where I've got to you know, choose one or the other. But fortunately, the Thursday night games collegiately haven't been that good. And you know, I think the NFL Network does a really good job with their Thursday night broadcast. So I mean, for the most part, I enjoy it. To me, any night there's football is a good night. I'll watch, you know, Mac football on Tuesdays. For me, I'm just kind of a junkie with it. So, you know, I don't have a preference. If it means one more night of football on a night I wouldn't be able to watch it, then, you know, I'm all for it.
All right. Thanks, Scott. I'm bringing Seth on the line. He's one of my co-hosts tonight. Seth, how you doing?
Good. How's everybody doing today?
I'm doing great. Glad to have you on. We've already got Scott on the line from Field Goals, so we're going to go ahead and get started. So, big matchup here Thursday night. Unfortunately for the Cardinals, they are currently 0-2 in the division, and they're coming off a tough loss, 32-20 to the San Francisco 49ers. How do Seattle Seahawks fan, and what's kind of the vibe heading into this game? How do they view the Cardinals? Is it one of the traditional looks where, okay, this is one of those games where we expect to win? Obviously, some of the fans are definitely in that camp since they're expecting now they're expecting 15-1 as the expectations have upped the notch a little bit. But do fans view the Cardinals as one of those games? As it's one of those gimmies? Is it going to be one of those tough places? Where does the level of respect or level of concern lie when you look at the Cardinals as an opponent?
I think it's actually surprisingly high for a couple of factors. One, I believe Seattle's either 1-5 or 1-6 in the last few games in Arizona. So there's a bit of a respect factor there. For whatever reason, it's been a tough place for the Seahawks to go and play. Obviously, you know, the early part of that run is when, you know, the Cardinals were having really good years and they had the Kurt Warner years, and the matchup was a little bit different. So that plays a role. You know, it's not an overly loud venue, or it just had a problem there for whatever reason. And then the other factor, too, is this, in Thursday night games, Seattle hasn't traditionally done very well either. So, you know, those two factors, I think, kind of have everybody I wouldn't even say cautiously optimistic. I think they're pretty even keeled about this game just because, you know, it's a short week. Health-wise, you know, there's a lot of guys banged up. And, you know, divisional opponents are always tough. I mean, I don't think anybody would have even, you know, from the outside looking in, expected Arizona to be competitive with San Francisco. But, you know, it was a relatively winnable game. And so, you know, I think that Seattle, you know, if you follow the division close enough, long enough, you know that anything can happen, and you factor kind of the Thursday night history and the, you know, road games in Arizona history. And, you know, I think that everybody's, you know, kind of anxious just to see the game. I don't think there's anybody too high with their expectations, you know, apart from the unrealistic group.
So how concerned, you talked about some of the injuries. Obviously, there's some concern there this week. Chris Clemens is banged up, didn't practice for a couple of days. Marshawn Lynch didn't practice today. Bobby Wagner hasn't practiced this week. To go along with the offensive line injuries, and Percy Harvin isn't quite ready to come back. He's still, a week or two away. Who is probably, as of right now, what is the biggest injury concern, probably the biggest hole you have when you're looking at the injury concern right now?
I think the offensive line is probably the biggest. I mean, it's gone on for a few weeks, so, you know, everybody's kind of just accepted it for being what it is. But it's still very much a factor. Last week, we were able to get Max Unger back, and that helped clean up some of the offensive line issues that existed against Houston and against Indianapolis. But, you know, protection's still an issue. Bobby Wagner being out will probably be the next biggest one. I think Lynch will be fine, so I don't really kind of factor that one in. But, you know, Wagner being out means you got to slide KJ right over to middle linebacker. So you got one guy playing out of place, and then, you know, you've got a backup filling in for KJ, and you know, just kind of that domino effect. So I think those are probably the two biggest, but if I had to choose one, it would definitely be the offensive line.
And looking at some of the statistics, people, especially here in Arizona, we rail on the offensive line play. We've been talking about our offensive line plays probably for the past 30, ever since Arizona had the Cardinals, ever since they came over in 88, there's been a bad offensive line.
But looking at the stats right now, at least looking at the passing game, Russell Wilson is, well, Seattle Seahawks quarterbacks have been sacked 17 times, and those are all, it was Wilson there each and every time. Well, the Cardinals have only given up 13. How much of that is the type of quarterback that Wilson is? Because he is a guy that is really dynamic at making plays later, well, at least kind of hanging around trying to make plays as protection breaks down. How much of that has been a case of offensive line play or just the type of player he is because he likes to he can make plays later in protection breakdowns?
Looking at it, it's actually mostly because of the offensive line play. I think actually the number is probably lower than it should be because of his playmaking ability, to be honest with you. You know, I know there's definitely that kind of school of thought where, you know, sometimes you get these dual threat guys who hold the ball too long and they try to do too much and they end up, you know, creating more harm than good for themselves. But I really don't think that's the case with Russell. You know, a lot of when you kind of look at the protection issues that they've had with the offensive line being out, it's been a lot of breakdowns, just missed assignments, and, you know, it's the sacks are coming really early, you know, in the progression. You know, he's not even getting to finish his drop, and he's got somebody in his face, and so, you know, there may have been a handful of him just trying to extend something, not quite being able to get out of it, but, you know, the majority of it's just been strictly because of the offensive line issues, and like I said, frankly, the number would be probably significantly higher if he didn't have the escapability that he does.
Okay. Now, Seth, anytime you feel like it, please jump in. Otherwise, I'll end up hogging the entire conversation. Is there anything you have right now that you want to get in to ask Scott?
Oh, I was waiting until you guys got to the defensive side of the ball for the Seahawks. So whenever you transition to there, I've got a couple questions.
Gotcha. Perfect. Arizona Cardinals fans, if you're listening to the show right now, this is Revenge of the Birds Radio. We're talking. We've got Seth Cox on the line, of course, to talk. He's holding on patiently as we're going to get ready to talk about the past game and discuss a little bit further the Seattle Seahawks game coming on. We also have Scott Enyard from Field Goals, fieldgoals.com, and SB Nation Seattle Seahawks site as we're talking to him about the upcoming game on Thursday. If you guys want to call in, if any of you wants to call in, comment, question, you can do that. We are live at 646-478-3787. Now, Scott, when we're talking about Russell Wilson, how is he doing this second year? Statistically, he's been pretty solid. Obviously, last year, perhaps one of the best statistical years that any rookie quarterback has had, and it was kind of a tale of two parts of the season, with the first five games being rather rookie-ish, and then the last 11 really turning on and looking absolutely fantastic. And while at least over here, kind of the national vibe, I haven't gotten the feeling that Wilson has been, oh my gosh, fantastic, but statistically got a QB rating of 92, 8 touchdowns, 4 picks. How is he doing this year?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's definitely not the same excitement right now that there was last season. I think last season, you know, just the way he finished those last 11 games was kind of, you know, upper echelon of the league. And I think right now he's playing kind of at a level that's, you know, I don't know, it's tough. When you just look at the statistics, it doesn't tell the whole story. You know, the Seahawks have struggled on third downs, but his ability as a runner has converted a number of them. And so he's done a lot to kind of keep them in games and you know, won a few games for him. In that regard, you know, the third down conversions against Tennessee, you know, his ability to run on a number of drives against Houston, you know, obviously those are two close games that, you know, they really had to rely on him on. You know, I think the biggest thing is just kind of his poise. You know, he struggled out of the gate early in a few games, and, you know, the defense kind of kept him in it. He doesn't really get rattled by that stuff. You can see some quarterbacks in this league that, you know, start off slow and they struggle a little bit and you say, oh, it's going to be an off night. And with Russell, I think what he brings to the table is just kind of, hey, if he starts off slow, you know he's going to finish pretty well because he just doesn't have those long kind of slumps in his play. You know, and again, I think there's a bit of, I guess kind of grading him on a curve, so to speak, just because of the offensive line issues as well. And everybody kind of understands he doesn't have a lot of time to sit back there and just, you know, pick open receivers and wait for guys to come open. He's kind of got to work with what he's got and throw something against the wall and hope it sticks. But, you know, it's more, you know, last year was kind of the hype and the stats. This year it's a solid season. He's turned the ball over a little bit. In fact, I think last week was the Tennessee game was the first game he didn't have a turnover. He's got the four picks, and then I think there was a fumble in another game. So, you know, which is kind of uncharacteristic compared to how he played last year. You know, so there's not an overwhelming excitement statistically. You know, like I said, everybody's kind of taking everything with a grain of salt until this team gets healthy.
Yeah, I was interested as I pulled up the stats, as I had not realized that Seattle had really kind of struggled as much as they had on third down. They're looking at what I think is 32% on the season compared to the Cardinals, and we've experienced, oh my gosh, third down has been terrible, and the Cardinals are not too far off that at 31.5%. So it's really been kind of a case of two teams that do things that kind of struggled there, but at the same time, which you guys do well, is run the football, averaging over 4.5 yards a carry on the season. Is that looking again, getting to Russell Wilson, we saw the San Francisco 49ers and Colin Kaepernick and how he played last year, and it was really kind of wide open, and they've had to, almost at the beginning of this year, they've turned him into, they've taken the responsibilities away from made him more game manager type player, almost like what Alex Smith was asked to do in the past couple of seasons, only with the bigger play potential. Is Russell Wilson's play, is he being asked to do much different? Is his role this year, or is it a case of we're trying to sit pat until we get everyone healthy?
That's a third thing. It's basically philosophically kind of what they want to do. Seattle, and even in all those years and all those big offenses at SC, he's a run-first guy. And, you know, he kind of feels like the run opens up the pass for them. And so, you know, part of the reason is because, you know, in this league, you know, a win, you got to win in January. And that means going on the road to some tough places and some tough weather. And that brand of football travels really well. You know, you don't want to be – you know, in these wide open, you know, throw everything offenses, and then you get some snowy game in Green Bay and you can't throw the ball around. So philosophically, they want to be a run-first team, and, you know, that's kind of the frustration that some of the fans have had, you know, when they just look at, you know, receiver numbers. There's not a whole lot of targets. There's not a lot of balls going around for guys. And so, you know, people are like, oh, well, you know, Sidney Rice isn't an elite receiver. We're paying him too much and this and that. It's like, well, no, he's getting about five less targets a game than Larry Fitzgerald is. And so, you know, it's just kind of how they like to do things. And, you know, Russell's not been asked to do a whole lot different. You know, I think last year was a bit of an anomaly for the 49ers and Kaepernick. I think he's always been pretty limited as a passer, but everybody kind of got excited with him coming off the bench and what he was able to do as a runner. And, you know, when you take that stuff away, I think his skill set's pretty limited. Whereas Russell's always been thought of really highly as a passer. The knock on him was his height. You know, everybody said, oh, if he's 2 inches taller, 3 inches taller, you know, he's a top 10 pick in that draft. And I don't think
I agree.
You know,
Wilson is a guy I absolutely gush over. I do that a little bit too often with a lot of players, but if I'm really, really envious of these young quarterbacks, of these teams with the young quarterbacks where they've got Andrew Luck. Yeah, he's Andrew Luck's going to be a star. Russell Wilson is a star. I mean, there's something just special about him. And one of the things I have the hardest time listening to is someone talking about the draft, a guy who can be the next Russell Wilson. Guys, there's not going to be another one. He's really kind of a once-in-a-lifetime player in the fact that he had everything in the skill set that you want when it came to poise, to leadership, to demeanor, to arm strength, to mobility, to decision-making. Just the only thing that brought him down was the height. And he showed that he could overcome that. You're not going to get that. We might not see another player like that in our lifetime. And I'm really kind of bummed that we don't have that quarterback on our team.
Oh, we got Johnny Manziel coming out this year. Everybody thinks he can be the next one because he's a little bit shorter. I laugh at the comparison for the exact same reasons you do. It's like, if you think those two are the same guy, you're out of your mind. Like, everything that Russell Wilson is off the field, you know, I mean, I'm not going to harp on Manziel, but it's like, you know, he overcomes the hype because of the way he prepares and his commitment, his leadership and all those things. And exactly right. You know, you can see somebody with maybe similar skills, you know, physically, you know, attributes like, you know, the ability to run, you know, just the way he throws the ball. But, you know, it's the other stuff that I think is what makes Russell kind of an outlier in that regard. And, yeah, you know, they don't come around that often for sure. So, you know, it's tough to be a team in need of a quarterback. And you know, it's a copycat league. Everybody's going to want to try and find the next one, but, you know, it's tough to find the next one.
No, it definitely is. Now, let's jump onto the defensive side of the ball so we don't bore Seth. And he's got questions. So we're talking defense now. What is it that Seattle does so well? Because they are such a physical team. What do they do best defensively? And perhaps what are the chinks in the armor that we could say or perhaps the Cardinals could exploit?
I think what they do best defensively is they limit explosive plays and they really, really play well in the red zone. And that's what they emphasize tremendously. You know, Earl Thomas is the kind of safety Earl Thomas is because he wanted a safety with range. He's going to take away the explosive play. And he's got probably the best range, you know, is certainly top three in the NFL in terms of his ability to just kind of be that deep center field type player. And, you know, they defend the run really well. I mean, it's a really balanced defense. Chink in the armor-wise, right now I think it's kind of because of the injury situation, it's probably a little bit of a linebacker play. They give up a lot of intermediate stuff in the passing game, and part of it's by choice because, like I said, they're more concerned about, hey, we're going to take away the big play. If you end up in the red zone, big play is not an option anymore, and then we can tighten up and take care of the underneath stuff, and they do a good job of that. But, you know, between the 20s, you know, teams can move the football on them, and I think that, you know, some games you can get away with it, other games you can't, and that would be probably the one, you know, I don't even want to say weakness, but that would be the area of concern that, you know, you have, you know, with this defense.
Which is interesting because of the kind of the knock on the Cardinals and Carson Palmer as a quarterback for his career is the ability to move an offense extremely well between the 20s and then make questionable decisions in the red zone, which makes for an interesting pairing. Seth, you are on the you're ready for this side of the ball. What questions do you have?
One of the things I've noticed in just going over the last two games before the Titans game this last week was Seattle gave up a lot of deep plays after being set up with those short passes. You talked about a little bit that they're susceptible in the intermediate. Is that partially just because of the aggressiveness of their scheme? It seems like they're always attacking and swarming downhill, and that's what I saw out of Earl Thomas a little bit, is that he kind of gets going in one direction, and then cornerback is looking for help over the top, and it's already too late. Saw that a little bit in the Houston game, saw that in the Seattle game. The Indy game. Is that just something that happens because of how aggressively they play in the secondary?
Yeah, I think that's a part of it. You know, I know a couple of plays you're talking about when they have given up those explosive plays the past few weeks, and you almost always see them, you know, they're kind of susceptible to that double move, man. If you're going to beat these guys, and you get deep on them, you know, it's a double move or it's a coverage breakdown, and I think that happens with that aggressive type play. You know, but again, I think it's a gamble that they're willing to take. You know, for every, you know, explosive play you give up, you get a pick six going the other direction. And, you know, so I think they're calculated risks. Again, like I said, at the beginning, I think they frustrated some portions of the fan base, you know, who want to, you know, win every game, shut everybody out, and have every game be a blowout. It's like, you know, Coach Carroll said this week, it's like, hey, the other teams are trying to win too. You know, they're not just going to roll over for you. You know, they're out here and they're putting together their best game plan. And, you know, and I think that that's, you know, their aggressiveness can be used against them, with the right quarterback and the right passing game. I think the Indianapolis game is a great example of it. T.Y. Hilton had a really big day, and Andrew Luck's obviously a gifted quarterback. And you know, they were able to, you know, do some things that left the secondary exploited a little bit. So, yeah, you know, to answer your question, I think it's a combination of the over-aggressiveness, but I think they're also okay with that. They're willing to kind of trade it off because they'll, you know, be able to force turnovers and make plays because of that aggressiveness as well.
Go ahead, Jess.
Go for it, Seth. I've been talking a lot,
right.
So...
The other question I had regarding the secondary was I've seen some reports and I noticed in a couple games that they're working Walter Thurman in to the rotation a little bit more on the outside as opposed to just being in the slot. Is that something that we'll see more often if Browner is, I don't want to say struggling because he's still playing well, but isn't playing up to what he was maybe in the past couple of years. Is that something we'll continue to see happen?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. I've never been a big Brandon Browner guy. I think he's the most expendable piece of the secondary. I think he does one thing really, really well. It's his, you know, his physical play, and he gets jammed at line of scrimmage. If you can get behind Browner, you know, that's where you can have success. And so, you know, conversely, Walker Thurman is a player that they've been high on for a long time. You know, his first two seasons, he battled injury. And you know, Pete and the secondary staff thinks the world of him. You know, they saw him a ton at Oregon and, you know, from Pete's days in the Pac-12 and Pac-10. And he's a guy for sure that's capable of kind of playing any of the spots. You know, he can play on the outside. He can play in the slot, and so they feel pretty good about his versatility. You know, I don't know if, you know, pulled Browner for a couple of series this game and, you know, didn't really say it was because of poor play, just kind of wanted to change it up is the quote that he used. You know, so we'll take him at his word. But, you know, regardless, I think that, you know, if it's Sherman that gets hurt or something like that, they're pretty confident in what Thurman's able to do and how he can help the secondary when called upon.
How's the pass rush? Obviously, we're looking at – you've got some injuries in the front. How satisfied is the team? And the 16 sacks that I see on the season, how much pressure is that team generating, is the defense generating? And how much does that comes off of straight four-man lining up and creating pressure, and how much of that comes off of the blitz?
Well, I'll say this. Last year, the pass rush had a lot of – people banging their heads, or I should say the lack of a pass rush had a lot of people banging their heads. And you don't hear about that as much this season, and I don't know if it's just because it's that much improved or just be based purely on the fact that they addressed it, you know, by getting, you know, Bennett and Ahab role and, you know, the first couple games, Bruce Irvin was obviously suspended, and, you know, Clemens coming off of injury, you know, so... You know, it's kind of hard to say in terms of where everybody's contentment is with it. I think that they kind of understand it's a work in progress, the people that are discontent with it. In terms of, you know, their ability to rush the passer, they've done a good job. You know, they don't blitz a ton. They like to get there with four. You know, it's just kind of how they like to do things. But, you know, they'll blitz when need to. And, you know, I haven't looked at the numbers, but I feel like just kind of, you know, and just thinking back how the season's gone, it's been pretty effective and pretty balanced both ways. But I think they've done a better job getting the passer this year than they did last year. I mean, last year it was like you couldn't get off the field on third down. Quarterbacks had all day to throw, and it was a frustrating, it was kind of a point of contention. This year, you know, it's improved, and like I said, I think for the most part, you know, with the understanding, it's still a work in progress. You know, you're still kind of getting the right combo of guys. You got, you know, every week someone different's out. You got, you know, Irvin who was suspended. You got, you know, Clemens who's coming off injury. You had Bennett, you know, you kind of had all those guys against Houston. Bennett gets hurt. You know, it's just been one thing after another. And even this week, you know, you may or may not have Clemens. You know, Bobby Wagner's out who, you know, doesn't blitz a ton as the middle backer, but, you know, he's still a part of it all. So, you know, I think that it's kind of one of those things where, you know, everybody's pretty pleased with it right now, but certainly could be better.
Seth, do you have anything else for him?
How much is Bruce Irvin just playing every snap now at defensive end, or is he playing at that linebacker position still as well?
He's been doing mostly the linebacker stuff. You know, it was weird. His first game back, he was, you know, he's kind of a force and you know, did a lot of good stuff against Indianapolis. I felt like it was a quiet game for him against Tennessee. I don't know what his stat line was against Tennessee, to be honest with you. But and I'm not in front of a computer right now. When you guys have it, but you know they like his versatility. They think that you know he brings a lot to the table, and certainly as a playmaker in the run game. I don't think he's great, and you know obviously pass coverage, but he's never going to be asked to do that. You know, for the most part, he's able to get after the quarterback, and you know he's a player that's been pretty effective. You know, when he got drafted, there was a lot of criticism. You know, people thought it was a risk, and in a lot of ways it was, but he had a good rookie season. And, you know, I mean, he's definitely a player that they still have a lot of optimism about. I think, obviously, you know, he's not he's a ways away from being considered, you know, one of the elite players on the defense. You know, when you have that secondary and some of those guys on the defensive line that you do, and, you know, other guys like Wagner, who, you know, is a second-year player and all that stuff, you know, the bar's been set pretty high. But I also think when you really step back and look at it, the sample size of what you've seen from Irvin is pretty small compared to those other guys. So, you know, they like I said, they like his versatility, and, you know, it seems like every time he's been involved, he's been pretty effective.
Going more general, and Seth, do you have any other questions for Scott?
Oh, no, I'm good. Thank you.
Wait, Scott, so talking more about the game, the Vegas line has Seattle by about 6.5, 7, depending on the sports book that you're looking at. Prediction time, and we're not going to be offended if you expect a big win by Seattle. Do you, how much we understand that Seattle is on paper a much better team. What type of prediction do you expect for this game? And it's all right, throw it out there. Are they winning? Are they winning outright? Are they going to cover that touchdown spread?
Well, you know, I have an uncle that lives in Phoenix, and I've always enjoyed Carson and you know, just going back. I played high school football against him in Southern California. You know, his days at SC. So I'm not as hard on him as you guys are. I actually think he's a pretty talented quarterback. He's just he can have hand at a lot of places. But and certainly pre-knee injury, Carson Palmer was a lot better than post-injury Carson Palmer. But I do think, you know, he's got ability to get stuff done. He's not a bad quarterback. And you know, he's just – he struggled. I mean, that's undeniable, but I do respect him and what he can do, especially if he can get Larry Fitzgerald the ball. That being said, I think Vegas is being pretty generous. You figure you get 3 points for being the home team, and so then you say if there's 7 to about 10 point, depending on what sports book you're at?
I've seen 6.5, 7, between 6.5, 7.5 is what I've seen.
Yeah, so 6.5, 7, so plus the 3 for being the home team, so you're thinking Seattle's 10 points better. And I just think, you know, like we talked a little bit about earlier, you know, you look at just the struggles that they've had at Arizona, the struggles that they've had on Thursday night and you know, the short week, the health issues, and you know, I'm not just expecting a blowout by any means. I just think that you know, history would kind of go against that, and then when you look at some of the other variables as well, I do think Seattle gets out of there with the win. I think they're, you know, just in a different spot in terms of, you know, how they've been built. I think, you know, Arizona's kind of half rebuilding, half not. You know, you've got some veterans who can do some things. You're trying to, you know, get the level of play with the younger guys around them to hopefully make a run at something. And, you know, you guys are in a tough spot. But that said, I think the veteran side of things, you know, makes for an interesting variable. It's not like just a young team rebuilding that you can kind of go in and bully. You know, so I think Seattle wins probably, you know, somewhere in that 3 to 7 range. You know, something like that.
Well, great. Well, I appreciate very much your time tonight, Scott. Thank you very much. That was Scott Inyard from fieldgoals.com. Anything else for the good of cause? Anything you'd like to share with our fans out here in Arizona?
No, I just share with us some of your weather. That'd be great. We're about to get pretty nasty up here. It's that time of year, so you know, we'll see you in April. We'll see the sun again in April. So if you want to share any of it with us, feel free.
That I would any way I can do that, I'll send it out there. I don't know if I can bottle that and put it in a package and mail it to you. I'd do it.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a wonderful night, Scott. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, you guys too. Take care.
Well, that was Scott Inyard from fieldgoals.com for SB Nation Seattle Seahawks site. Again, this is Revenge of the Birds Radio. I'm your host, Jess Roots, and you can give us a call at 646-478-3787. And now we're going to get back to our regular part of the show, Seth. Thanks for waiting patiently. Thanks for your input. And let's get down to this nitty-gritty. We're talking about the Cardinals game, 32-20. Cardinals kind of had that game in. It almost, you felt that the Cardinals had the game in hand, just like Bruce Arians said afterwards. They're down 2 points. They're driving. Then Larry Fitzgerald fumbles the ball. Now, Carson Palmer threw 2 first quarter interceptions. Larry Fitzgerald fumbles it in the third quarter, turns it over. Alphonso Smith coughs at the ball late in the game in the fourth quarter. Play calling was kind of an issue again. they've run the ball successfully. When they're running the ball successfully, they're moving the ball. And then when they're not moving the ball, got the problems there. Well, let's play kind of the blame game as we start off, Seth. Where are we going to lay the blame for the loss or overall? Where do you place the blame?
I put it on a couple spots. First one, I think you have to start out with Carson. Just the offense, the way the offense is based, the way that they run the offense, it goes through the quarterback and coming out and kind of putting your team in a hole, even though the defense did a great job of covering that up and, you know, keeping it to only 6 points. That's a huge hole to dig out of. And I understand that they, you know, had numerous chances to, you know, win the game later and things like that. But when you start out in a hole and working, you know, basically working from a negative, it makes no matter what you do right the rest of the game. And Carson Palmer played very well after that second interception. It makes everything else, you know, not really matter because of how poorly you started. Secondly, I think I don't know if you can place blame on any certain person or coach. I just think the inability to cover a tight end is just – it's so absurdly infuriating at this point that you know that the Cardinals are going to get toasted by a tight end, and you just hope that it's not as bad as it was yesterday. I mean, you look at the stats, and, you know, I haven't even gone back to watch the Carolina game because I've heard nothing but bad things despite the win. But Greg Olsen had almost, I think, 80 yards receiving.
Greg Olsen, 5 catches, 79 yards, all in the first half.
Greg Olsen is not, you know, he's not really a good tight end anymore. He's a weapon that can be used at times, but he's more of, you know, a security blanket. He's a better man's Jim Dre at this point. He's not, you know, a special player anymore. And he put up good numbers. I mean, the Cardinals would kill to have a tight end catch 5 passes for 80 yards. So it's to the point where, you know, a lot of people thought, oh, Darrell Washington's back, you know, things will get better. And you don't want to say it's gotten worse, but it hasn't gotten better. So I guess it's just the same thing. And it gets frustrating to know that that's going to be what teams are going to look to exploit. And not only do they exploit it, but they exploit it to the point where you're losing games because of it.
And we're going to – I'll table the tight end issue for a little bit, as we do have that that topic coming up a little bit later. But I've been really interested – it's been very interesting to me to see the reaction to fans about that fumble that Larry Fitzgerald had. Because of the fact he's Larry Fitzgerald, everyone's kind of saying, oh, that's a bummer. Anywhere else and any other player on this team, we are killing. And that's not to say Fitz will be the first one. He felt terrible. He says he let his team down. He put the ball on the ground. And in that situation, you can't. And despite the bad start, that was essentially the turning point in the game. Cardinals were about to take the lead, whether it was by 1 point or 5 points. They were about to take the lead, and they cough up the ball, and then 9.5 minutes later, San Francisco goes up by 9. If I had to place blame, I'm putting it on that single play right there when Fitz inexplicably loses the ball. It doesn't hardly ever happen, but I've been very interested in how fans in general, and unnecessarily so because there's nobody harder on himself. There's no harsher critic of Larry Fitzgerald than Larry Fitzgerald. And people are saying, oh, it's not Larry's fault. It's not Larry's fault. What about those passes that were overthrown? What are those passes he didn't come up with that were nowhere near? I'm like, that's nice, but what about the fumble? I'm putting that particular turning point on Larry Fitzgerald with kind of complimentary blame. Of course, it's a team game. You can't ever place them on one thing. Good Carson, bad Carson. He had bad Carson at the beginning of the game. And then, of course, just the just the again, like you said, the inability that last drive. They could not stop San Francisco. Even in, and I charted this out, they had they ran in that 18 play drive, I think about 10 plays defensively. They were stacked up to the off box with an 8-man front, and they couldn't do anything. They just plain couldn't stop San Francisco.
Yeah, and to go back to the Fitz thing, one of the issues I always have with placing blame on a single turnover in a game is that we have no idea what the outcome would have been of that drive. Who knows? Palmer could have thrown another pick.
True.
So when Larry makes a mistake like that, because he's fumbled 6 times in his entire career, it's just one of those anomalies that I kind of just shrug my shoulders at. Like you said, that's what's happened. But it's one of those things, to me, it's like, well, you know, it was a terrible play. It's unfortunate of the timing of when it happened, but, you know, what happens in the end is still hard for me to you'd hope that everything would have worked out. They would have scored a touchdown and things would have gone great, continued to go well, and the defense wouldn't have been gassed anyways. And who knows at that point, you know, what happens on the defense, because they were already gassed, it looked like. As you said, the resulting drives after that kind of showed that. So it was just a conglomeration of all the bad things happening at once. Your best offensive player fumbles the ball for the first time in 5 years, and your defense that's been bailing you out all day all of a sudden can't get a stop. It was pretty much the worst-case scenario that could have happened. And so it's one of those things that I agree completely. You know, he's got to know better to tuck the ball. It's one of those things that he's actually lucky he doesn't have more fumbles, because that's one of the things that he's known for, is stretching out that one hand to try to get a little extra yardage. And, Patrick Willis is just an all-pro for a reason, and he just made a play, and it was unfortunate. And, you know, I agree. It probably was a turning point of the game, but I think the resulting defensive series kind of showed that even if they would have scored a touchdown and gotten ahead by 5, that defense wasn't going to get a stop in that next series. They were gassed, and you're at that point, you're just hoping that they hold them to a field goal and you're able to sustain a drive for the, you know, first time in 6 weeks. So,
well, Ben piped in. Ben's under the weather tonight, so he wasn't able to call in, actually, Todd, but he's piping in on Twitter right now. He sent me a couple of tweets. He talked about, well, kind of where he throws the blame around that is with the play calling or the decision making, whether it was the play calling or the combination of play calling and decision making by Carson Palmer, where he was forcing passes to Fitz on first and second down, or throwing to Ellington, Jerron Brown, or Britton Golden on third down when it counted, as opposed to finding Fitz or finding your more reliable targets. And then he's silly, is the word they said. On the Fitz fumble, it happened, it sucks, but he has the track record, just have to accept and move on. I agree. But the phenomenon that's interesting for me is just, if Fitz played at any other market, he would have been much more criticized. There was nothing in print anywhere that was going to talk about that fumble other than what he said himself. Moving on to the next topic is, and again, Arizona Cardinals, those of you who are listening tonight at Revenge of the Birds Radio, if you want to chime in, you can tweet me at Revenge of Birds or at Senor Jess Root, or you can give us a call at 646-478-3787. We'll be glad to talk to you. As we talk about, one of the things we talked about is Carson Palmer. Once again, 2 more picks, has yet to leave a game, finish a game without having a pass picked off. He's got 11 interceptions on the year, and were it not for incredibly bad Eli Manning this year, Carson Palmer probably would be right up there on quarterback criticism. But, he's Carson Palmer, he's playing for the Cardinals, doesn't get kind of the recognition for that. And particularly, you've brought it up on Twitter, inexplicably, both Steve Keim and Bruce Arians are very quick to defend the quarterback for whatever reason, whether it's justified or not. We've got good Carson, bad Carson. He's yet to put together a good game from start to finish. Either it's in the middle, he has a hiccup, or the beginning of the game, it's just like beginning of the game. I mean, San Francisco, that game with the starters was just awful. And then there seems to be a point in the game, and it literally was that he, after the second interception, he turns to his teammates and said, "I got it." Like he didn't understand before, then he understood, and it all goes well from there. When will he put a full game of good football together, and how patient do we need to be because of that? And especially, he plays well. When he plays well, he's playing well, but he's putting us in holes early or making dumb decisions in the middle of the game, so you're stuck pulling your hair for this, what Carson Palmer is as a quarterback this year.
I think it starts with understanding that barring injury or him, you know, throwing a punch at Bruce Arians, I really don't see any way he's pulled or taken out of the starting lineup. He's the quarterback, and, you know, for better or worse, and that's, you know, that's admirable in a sense, because it shows you that this is what Bruce Arians believes in. He believes in Palmer to the extent of, you know, complete stubbornness. That's not a bad thing. That's just, you know, complete stubbornness. And he wants him to succeed. So, you know, he's going to put all his eggs in that basket and, you know, kind of live with the results. And that's not a bad thing. You know, if Arians believed in Drew Stanton as much as Arians has talked about, he believes in Drew Stanton, we would have seen Drew Stanton by now. So, because, you know, Palmer has completely and justifiably been bad enough in the last two games, you know, and like you said, he ended up being good Carson down the stretch against San Francisco. And you could really go back, and he's been bad enough in three consecutive games that after that second pick, Arians had every justification to pull him and just say, okay, you need to take the day off. You need to be done. You know, just watch. And, you know, and nobody would have said anything because he had thrown seven interceptions in the last, you know, however many pass attempts. I think he only threw six pass attempts before he threw both interceptions. So, quick math. So if this is wrong, I'm sorry. But so he threw seven interceptions in 72 pass attempts, you know, going back to the Tampa Bay game. That's just unacceptable from, you know, a veteran quarterback. And so I think at this point it's you're going to just have to live with what he does, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. This is kind of where we're at right now, and this is what we'll have to deal with, unfortunately. It's going to be, you know, like I said, absurdly, you know, infuriating at times, but there's going to be some good, and hopefully the good outweighs the bad eventually.
And it's really kind of interesting. One of the dynamics that I personally have noticed is how this leadership between Steve Keim and Bruce Arians, Arians specifically, the things that they say in public, because Arians has, you know, everyone has been just eating up everything Arians says, like, oh, this is football truth. This is so much different than everyone. And I say, yes, I tend to throw this out there all the time. Remember how much he was gushing about Bruce Stanton? He was gushing about Bruce Stanton when they signed him. But yet Steve Keim flat out says on the radio, you kind of get the feeling, well, they really don't believe in Drew Stanton as a starter. I think they would have gone, they would have survived with him somehow, kind of with the terrible year to get a better pick, surviving that. But when Steve Keim comes on the radio and says, you know, he's our best option, flat out, no questions asked. He is, Carson Palmer's our best option. Stanton's living a good life, honestly. He's making a lot of money, backing up and not having to do a whole lot, putting a lot of prep work, and he's a great, great quarterback to have on the team. But if you look at the track record now we have with Bruce Arians and the leadership talking about the players, Levi Brown's elite. Wait, nope, never mind. We're going to cut him, and then we traded him. You've got Ryan Williams. Well, you've got the injury issues where they talk about what's true, what's not true. Darren College comes to mind. Larry Fitzgerald's hamstring being the same hamstring when it was a different hamstring. He says stuff, you know, he's a coach, he just says stuff. But he is very, very overly supportive of his players in public sometimes. And then at the same time, he's saying, our receivers are being terrible, they're running the wrong routes. I love the tweet that you gave as I was chatting on Twitter with Sean Church and Kent Hodder from the site, particularly the interception, the first interception that Carson threw. And Kime said flat out, well, the receiver, it was Dre. Dre threw the wrong route. Palmer threw it right where the ball was supposed to be, where Dre was supposed to be, and it was picked off. Your tweet response is, I've seen a lot of excuses made for the interception. Either the wide receivers or tight ends aren't good enough. Aren't good, or Palmer isn't. And I think it's kind of depending on the play, it's a little bit of both. Do you see that being the case? It isn't necessarily one or the other, but we're definitely not getting everyone on the same page offensively. So some plays were bad. I mean, Larry sometimes doesn't know where he's supposed to be. Carson, either he knows the offense really well, or he's having as many mental mistakes as his receivers.
Yeah, and that's kind of been the frustrating thing to watch more than anything else for me has been the mental errors. I don't know where to place blame a lot of times when I, you know, break down film. So you kind of have to just be very conservative with where you place the blame. You know, you can say it looks like the receiver ran the wrong route, or it looks like the quarterback threw the ball to the wrong area. You know, that's as far as you really want to go in that, because we don't know the ins and outs of the calls and everything like that. But what we do know, what is completely, you're completely able to break down and judge, are things like the mental errors you've seen from Carson Palmer, the delay of game, you know, penalty against San Francisco is the first one that comes to mind. You're in a hurry up situation where you have, you know, I believe they had all three timeouts on top of it, and you're in a hurry up situation, and you're coming off an incomplete pass, and you still find a way to get a delay of game penalty, whether it was somebody else's fault or not for lining up wrong or whatever. He's the quarterback. He sees what's going on. He sees the play clock, call a timeout, regroup, and get ready. You can't take 5 yards because your offense hasn't been good enough all season to gain those extra 5 yards. So it's just simple things like that that are actually more frustrating to me. I mean, the interceptions are confounding at times, and I've counted 5 where I've said that I have no idea what he was looking at or seeing. And so, you know, that's kind of 5 interceptions that you just kind of scratch your head and say, okay, well, I have no idea what that was. But that's still at least 6 interceptions that he threw where, you know, maybe he tried to force a ball that he shouldn't have tried to force, or, you know, somebody else's fault. So that's still a lot of interceptions if you take off just the bad ones that, you know, are kind of inexplicable. So his play has been, it's been rookie-like, let's put it that way. You wouldn't think that this is a guy that's been in, you know, 4 different offensive systems over the last decade and, you know, has Pro Bowls to his name and that type of things. He does actually look more like the guy that's been jettisoned from 2 franchises for unknowns. So, you know, it's kind of that rough, you know, intermediate where you want to believe things are going to get better, but there's that thought in the back of everybody's mind, I think, that says, wow, did we just kind of get our hopes up that this, you know, Carson Palmer thing was going to be better than it actually, you know, than what it will be?
Here's some numbers that Ben sent these via Twitter, and they, at least initially to start the season, Palmer has 11 interceptions and 221 passing attempts. 2012, John Skelton, 201 passing attempts, 9 interceptions. Granted, we'll say John Skelton didn't have some of the production in, and there's a whole lot. You can't put those two, but the numbers, at least with the turnovers, are the same. The one thing that I am going to give credit to Palmer is, as a quarterback, as a veteran quarterback, one thing he does really well that actually has been to his detriment with the offenses, with players, with either he's on the wrong page or the receivers are on the page, is that he's not afraid to throw the ball to a spot before a receiver gets there. That's something that John Skelton couldn't do. That's something Kevin Cobb was unwilling to do. He was unable to anticipate plays. Matt Leinart was in a – he's a guy who couldn't do that. Kurt Warner could. Kurt Warner anticipated very well and had a handle on the offense and turned the ball over. That's the one thing I am impressed with, and his demeanor is good. So if he screws up, he doesn't get down on himself and he fixes things. But I do like the fact – and what gives me reason to be optimistic is that at some point, hopefully not before too late, that the offense will finally click, and those places he's throwing the ball where there's no receiver there, there's going to be a receiver there because he's putting the ball where the ball or someone is supposed to, where he believes someone's supposed to be, and he's trusting his teammates to do that. That's something we haven't seen in years as a quarterback to be able to do that, is that anticipation.
Yeah, but I think a part of it, and this is something that I have been researching. I know Sean does a great job with the numbers from sites like Pro Football Reference and Pro Football Focus and things like that, but I kind of wanted to delve in myself to these numbers, and so I found them intriguing, kind of going off what you're talking about with the anticipation and throwing the balls to spots. I think part of the reason he's struggling or throwing so many interceptions is because, you know, he's consistently facing seven defensive backs, or, you know, not seven defensive backs, but seven guys in coverage. And so the windows he's throwing in are really small. Of the 11 interceptions he's thrown, 10 of them have been against four-man rushes when he has not been blitzed. That's really bad. I mean, that's really, really awful, because that means that you don't have to identify the blitzer. You don't have to identify, you know, where your check is or anything like that. All you have to do is run the play that you run, you know, against shell defenses. I understand it's completely different in the secondary, and, you know, they may be disguising coverages and such, but that just means that, you know, end up being under pressure, and on half of those plays he has been under pressure, you still know where the rushers are coming from. It's still four guys, and they're coming from the front. There's nobody hidden that he's throwing, or, you know, he's having to deal with. So when that happens, he's making either bad reads, or he's trying to fit the ball into, you know, areas that he really shouldn't be. When he is blitzed, which isn't often, of his 235 dropbacks, he's only been blitzed 52 times. He's doing really well. He's completing passes. He's completing 54% of his passes, which may not sound like a great number, but against the blitz, it's not bad. And he's only thrown one interception. So it's not, you know, it's a combination of the offensive line can't stop a four-man rush, so he's having to consistently throw under pressure into tight coverages. But it's also, is he getting confused by, you know, coverages in the secondary because there are seven men dropped every time? Or is it because he is making the right reads, but he doesn't have the arm strength or the ability to fit the ball into the windows anymore? I think it's kind of a combination of all the bad, and that sounds bad, but I think it's kind of a combination of all of that. I don't know that he's necessarily confused, but I think he's seeing a lot of bodies back there that he's probably not used to seeing, honestly.
Oh, and one of the things is interesting is the reputation that Carson Palmer has had throughout his career is on a national level. Doesn't matter who's back there in coverage. If the ball's supposed to go there, he's going to try and put the ball there. And I think it's more of a case that he trusts his player and he trusts his ability too much. And so if he's got lots of people in coverage, he knows that's where the ball's supposed to go. He feels, I can put that ball there. And so he tries it. and that's the – he's been – that's kind of been the case. Ben sent a tweet that said, puts the ball in the spot no matter how many defenders are in that spot. That's kind of been Carson's MO his entire career. If he feels a ball's supposed to go into that spot, he is blindly loyal to it and puts the ball there, even if it's ill-advised.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that when I talked to Joe Goodberry, he used to be of Cincy Jungle. Now you look at him, and or Joe's kind of doing his own thing. But I talked to Joe, and I talked to Chris Hansen of Bleacher Report, who used to run a Raiders blog, and they both said the kind of same thing. He throws these maddening interceptions because he thinks he has more on what he's throwing, or he thinks he can fit the ball into a spot that he just can't fit the ball into. So all of a sudden, you know, you look at it and it's like, well, that was just a dumb throw. But like you said, he's kind of like Kurt Warner in that way. He believes in his ability. The difference was, you know, that Kurt was throwing touchdowns too. So
yes.
I think, you know, I think if he was at, you know, 11 and 11 or 13 and 11, people wouldn't be as, you know, kind of calling for Stanton. And, you know, as I said in the article that is going up on the site tomorrow, you know, that's it. I don't think that's smart. You know, we don't need to be calling for Stanton. If, you know, if they believed in Stanton, they would have gone out and gave up picks to get Carson Palmer. But, you know, it is what it is at this point. And, you know, he's throwing a ton of interceptions and he's not producing positive results to kind of justify those interceptions.
So let's move on from Carson Palmer, because we're going to just end up banging our heads on the wall so much. To talk a little about the running game, which has been another source of headbanging against the wall. We've got Andre Ellington being extremely effective in the running game. He now has another 56 yards rushing on the ground. He's averaging 7 yards a carry. He's seeing production in the passing game. Now, the overall running game wasn't fantastic, but the Cardinals did manage to rush 409 yards. Why do we not run the ball more? Because every single time it seems that we commit to more than a token run play or two, the drives end up being successful. And I understand it. Ben and I talked about it last week. Is what is it, the chicken or the egg? Is it the fact that they aren't running the ball well enough that they say, well, that's not working, and so they give up on it? Or is it because they're finally going for it, that they're finally trusting the run, that it's being successful? Why don't the Cardinals run the ball more? I mean, in the end, it was interesting, the playing time. Andre Ellington led the snap counts on the running backs with, I think, 32, which is right in the range that Arians wanted. Rashard Mendenhall was only on the field, I think, 20-something, in the low 20s in snaps, and got 10 carries, 40 yards. A very Rashard Mendenhall performance. But even still, Rashard Mendenhall, who is a more of a workhorse type of back, still isn't getting enough touches to produce what I would imagine that we would expect him to be able to produce. And I know part of that is injury-based or just banged up, nicked up a little bit. But at the same time, why in the world was Alphonso Smith running the ball in that play late in the game? That is inexplicable to me. But why don't, aside from Bruce Arians just hating to run the ball, why don't we do it more?
Well, I'm probably overly, I don't know what the word is. I probably make too many excuses for Alphonso Smith. But it's always a player's fault when he fails physically. So a fumble, you know, is a physical mistake. So, you know, you can't put that on anybody else. But as you said, why is he even getting a rushing attempt at that point in the game? He hadn't run the ball at all the rest of the game. What is the point of giving him a carry at that point? It just seemed kind of out of left field.
Why is that his first carry? I mean, if he had seen the – I mean, Stephon Taylor had carried the ball twice before that. He's gotten hit a couple of times. Why make that his first carry? I didn't get that.
Yeah, and that's what I was confused about. So, you know, yes, it was still on Alfonso for the fumble and things like that, but just the call in and of itself made no sense. I'm just kind of looking at the numbers. So they ran the ball 21 times against the 49ers. Fonzo got one carry. Larry, did he get a carry, or was that a behind the kind of line of scrimmage pass that they're counting as a run? Either way, if they're going to run the ball 21 times, it either needs to be 15 for Mendenhall and 6 for Ellington, or just put Mendenhall on the bench and give the ball to Ellington, you know, 12 times and give Stephon Taylor the other 9, or, you know, activate that guy on the inactive list every week and see what he has. But as you and I have kind of, you know, you said banged our head against the wall, we've done this 100 times, but Mendenhall's not Andre Ellington. He cannot produce 56 yards on 7 carries. He probably couldn't produce 56 yards on 10 carries. He's a career average 4 yards per carry guy. That's what he's going to do. And that's what he's always done. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you have that knowledge that that's what a player does, if that's who the player has been through his entire career, then expecting a different result or being okay with those results and not using them to the most effectiveness, to me, is kind of insanity. We all want Andre Ellington to get more touches, but you're probably giving Ellington the right amount of touches in the run game. He could probably handle 3 to 5 more, you know, be up around 10 to 12 carries a game, but he's getting an additional 4 to 6 touches through the air every game. He should be right around, you know, 16 to 20 touches a game, and that's a great number for him every game. The problem is Mendenhall needs 18 to 22 touches, and by touches, I mean carries. I don't want Rashard Mendenhall catching the ball at all. I don't want Rashard Mendenhall, you know, running screen plays. If you're going to use Rashard Mendenhall, give him 18 to 22 carries and just let him wear down a defense, because that's kind of what he does. You know, he's kind of like Frank Gore, but he's not nearly as good as Frank Gore. But he's going to produce, you know, a lot of 3-4 yard carries. And then all of a sudden in the fourth quarter when the defense is gassed, you can lean on him and let him go down the field and carry the ball. I think Gore carried it 8 times on that 18 play drive. You can do that with a back like Mendenhall. The problem is he has to get, you know, more than 10 carries to do that. They're not going to do it, so then he's kind of useless. And as you and I have talked about, then find other players, because you're not, you know, putting your guys in the best position to be successful at this point.
Now, so we move on from the running game. Injuries, we're going to touch on that just a little before we get to more of the pressing issue. How concerned are you with the injury situation? Obviously, Calais Campbell had himself a bit of a scare. It was, being the type of injury it was, there were much more precautions. Calais himself said he wanted to get up on his own. He didn't feel it was that big a deal. Bruce Arians said on the radio today that he was medically cleared to play. Dan Williams said it would take a straitjacket to keep Calais out of the game. So I'm expecting him to play. Fitz still, you know, has the hamstring issue. Arians says, you know, it gets better and then it gets worse when he plays. Fitz today said, "What are you talking? This is. There's no excuses. It's a Thursday night game on national television against the division rivals. He's going to play. How concerned are you about the injury issues? Do you fear that a dinged up Larry Fitzgerald isn't going to be as effective? Although he did have his best game of the season with the 6 catches, 117 yards, and his hamstring didn't seem to be an issue on the 75 yard run that he had. Of course, that might have been a little bit what hampered him a little bit later in the game, but are you at all concerned about the injuries on the Cardinals side?
I've been concerned about it. I think the first thing is that you have Larry, who kind of to follow up what you said, I thought he kind of eased up at the end. I don't know if it was just kind of taking the foot off the gas because he knew he was going to score, but it seemed like it could have been that he was, you know, he kind of felt the tweak in the hammy at that point because he didn't look the same after that. But, you know, I said to Sean on Twitter, there's no reason he should have played that game. I know he's a competitor. I know he had a great game statistically, but there wasn't any reason to play in that game. You're paying the guy $15 million a year, and you need him to be healthy on the back end of this schedule when there all of a sudden are a lot more winnable games than there might, you know, than there was earlier. You look at it, I would have sat him. I'm not the coach. I'm not Larry. I have not, you know, but I would have sat him. I would have said, just get healthy. I haven't watched the Carolina game. I don't know what happened, but, you know, did he look kind of sluggish against Carolina? I mean, I have no idea, honestly. So, you know, it just seems like it's been a consistent issue for almost the entire season. So, you know, why not sit him and get him healthy for the stretch run when you could probably make some hay and put yourself in the race for a wild card? The rest of the injuries are, you know, they're always a concern, especially anything like with Calais that happened. But, you know, if Calais plays, they're fine. Depth-wise on defense, I'm not really concerned right now. Tyrann Mathieu is just showing that he might be, you know, one of the better players in the, you know, just in the league eventually. He's just so dynamic the entire time. So, you know, with Rashad Johnson still struggling with the finger, it looks like. I know he played 11 snaps on special teams, but he's just, you know, they may not be ready. But the defense, other than depth, I think it's been, you know, I think they'll be okay with the injuries. I just would, you know, I always want to err on the side of caution with hamstrings because they can linger for so long, and it looks like it has been with Fitz.
Well, and I know he's going to play Thursday. This is actually a perfect timing. Kind of he gets the week and a half before Atlanta, and then after Atlanta, he gets the bye. And so if he can tough it out Seattle, he's going to get a little bit better against Atlanta, and then he's got the bye week. And I think it's not the bad way to go. He's kind of got to play. I mean, they really do need him. Sean tweeted in, say, that something was lacking Fitz in San Francisco despite the long touchdown, didn't have the small space explosion. I have to agree with that. And Ben tweeted as well. If your stars can play versus division opponents, they have to plan it. And this is as close to, at this point in the schedule, a must-win game for the Cardinals as it is. If they fall to 0-3 in the division, pretty much the division's out of reach. And based on the division situation, yes, there's still a lot of games left on the schedule, but you fall to 3-4 and you're 0-3 in the division. Even though you can make up some wins later on, I think they're going to be behind the eight ball for just in the playoff race in general, even though there's a lot of time left in the season. This is as close to as a must-win game as you can call it. I called it a must-win game. I downgrade it to a really, really, really important game for them to win as opposed to a must-win. But definitely a must-win in the division.
Yeah, I think if you want to, and, you know, kill me if you guys want to, I still don't see them as division contenders, but I think if you want to be taken seriously within the division as a contender, then this is kind of the must-win game. I just think that you need to find a way to get to 2-2 in your next four games, so, you know, you need to figure out a way to get through to the bye week and come out of the bye week healthier than you are right now and win some games after that as well. Because I really don't want to be the team that loses to Jacksonville, but we'll get to that later. but
please don't be that team. That would be so embarrassing.
Yeah, that all would right. really...
Let's,
but
Let's move on to the next topic of the tight end concerns. You said that's one of the major issues. The tight ends have been putting up insane numbers up against the Cardinals, and at least at some of that, a lot of those big plays, I think I counted, it was three of the plays to Vernon Davis. There was 28, there was a 37, and there was the 61. I believe three of those three big plays, those came as a result of the eight-man front that they had, and so you did kind of lose a little bit of the protection in the defensive backfield. So I know partially, at least in San Francisco, that part of the reason why Davis took care of them over the top on those particular plays was the fact that they were taking some risk with going with a four-man line and a four-man set of linebackers on the field at the same time. And three times, they were taken advantage of. That calculated risk, at least in that case, there was a risk-reward. They also picked off a pass in that same set. Carlos Dansby knocked away a pass that was intended for Davis. It was a beautiful play. And they did solid against the run, so they did what they needed to do. I think it came out to 19 plays, 19 runs for 68 yards against that eight-man front. And one of those was a 15-yard run by Gore. So you take that 15 yards away, and then they really were effective. But what happened is when you have a guy like Vernon Davis, who really isn't so much a tight end as he is a nightmare of a receiver for matchups, and at least against San Francisco, I'm willing to give him those plays came in part. Some of those numbers are because of the stacked box they were playing.
Yeah, and you look at it, and that's I was talking to Sean and Kent earlier today, and they were praising the play of Jeremiah Bell, and he played really well against the run. He was beaten up in the passing game a little bit. I know he had the interception and a pass breakup, but he gave up four catches and 108 yards to Vernon and both touchdowns. So, you know, Vernon kind of took his lunch in that sense in the passing game. And my thing was, it's really hard. I know you want to play to stop the run against San Francisco and then, you know, against New England, it's kind of, well, or excuse me, against New Orleans, it's kind of, well, it's Jimmy Graham, what are we going to do type thing. But at this point, it's kind of getting to the point of, you know, just being absurd. And you have other options. Try them. I mean, like I said, I haven't won a Carolina game, but Greg Olsen had a good game, and Darryl Washington was back, so that means, you know, I'm not saying Washington covered him at all or exclusively.
No,
or
it really didn't.
Like that.
In fact, Bruce Arians, because the question came up this week in the press, is the fact that they're not going to – and talk about Vernon Davis, for example, having Darryl cover him. He said, no, really, he's not going to be able to match up because the only – If Davis is lined up wide, he's not taking Darryl Washington out of the box to do that. And so you're left with the reason. That's why you end up with Jerod Powers out in coverage. That's why with Jeremiah Bell out there is because when the opposing offenses put their tight end out wide, they're not sending a linebacker. Now, they do that with Dansby a little bit. They will send him out in coverage if they go wide a little bit, but they don't do that at all with Darryl Washington.
Yeah, and that was kind of my thought then is, which is fine, I have no problem with that, but then why aren't you trying something different? Expecting something else to happen is kind of just absurd to me, or expecting, you know, things to get better. It's now been, I think, five games where tight ends have had season-high statistics against or, you know, their season-high statistics against the Cardinals. And I don't think I charted his number wrong, so I had to go back and look at the numbers again. But Tony Jefferson didn't get on the field defensively against San Francisco. And,
nope.
You know, he may not be, you know, the biggest or fastest guy, but he's at least a different look at this point on tight ends, so give them a chance. I know that means you have to take Carlos or Jeremiah, and they both played really, really well against San Francisco in the run game, and I know that makes things difficult, but you know, you're getting your heads bashed in by the tight end, but you're saying to yourself, well, we're stopping the run, so it's okay. That's just, I don't know. To me, that's, I just don't like that idea. You know, if something's beating you, but you're stopping something else, you don't just say, well, we'll continue to let this beat us because we're stopping, you know, everything else. Because then at the end of the game, you were getting gashed in the run game as well. And it was to the point where you couldn't stop the run because you were so tired from chasing Vernon Davis around the field all day. So, I don't know. It was an interesting dynamic to me, and I didn't really understand it. But, you know, it is what it is at this point, and they've got to figure something out. They have to they have to figure something out, or, you know, and maybe this is just what they think at this point. They say, well, we know we can't cover tight ends. We'll let that be our weak spot, but we won't let anything else be our weak spot. And if that's the way they're –
And unfortunately, though, what that's been is that it's really hurt them. It would be one thing if they could say, yeah, this will hurt us, and it hurts them. But this has been detrimental to the fact that it's losing them games, which is ridiculous. It's things that we haven't tried. They've sent – I know they've had in coverage. They've had Tyrann Mathieu in coverage. They've had a lot of Jerod Powers in coverage. They've had Jeremiah Bell in coverage. One thing, we've seen Carlos Dans being covered. We haven't seen Darrell Washington go out wide to cover. We haven't seen Rashad Johnson, other than in deep support. We haven't seen Tony Jefferson, which is interesting. I'm guessing Rashad Johnson, who came in last year on those nickel packages, I'm guessing his strength isn't the man-on-man coverage, but rather the deep support that he's where he's supposed to be, because it's really interesting is the fact that it's the same thing week after. It really is. It's the same thing week after week.
Yeah, and you know, you look at it, they haven't, and I don't think Antoine Kayson's any good at all, but they haven't even given Antoine Kayson a chance to do it. I mean, at some point, you have to try something different, or you're just going to, like you said, you're going to continue to get beat by the same thing week in and week out, and, you know, it's going to cost you a season.
Let's look at the game for Thursday. What are your keys to the Thursday night game? I mean, we're still got a little bit. We got 8 minutes left in the broadcast. Let's give it, Seth. What are your keys to the game Thursday night for a Cardinals win?
The keys to the game are going to be kind of what I talk about tomorrow in my article, and that's one. You want to see this passing offense getting gear. I know people are saying, well, it's, you know, it's Seattle. They're, you know, they have the Legion of Boom back there. Best, you know, secondary in the NFL, without a doubt. But you know what? I watched Matt Schaub pick them apart for a half. This is a team that you can take advantage of, and you can, you know, you can take advantage of their over-aggressiveness and the fact that, you know, this is, they play a very aggressive style. You can get a lot of misdirection plays in your routes. You can get a lot of guys running free in your routes. And to do that, you know, you're going to have your quarterback, your veteran quarterback, and your, you know, pretty veteran-laden team. I know Roberts and Hausler are young, but they've been in the league now 3 years and 4 years, respectively. They should be, you know, doing a little bit more than what they have been. So I want to see, you know, this team, you know, put together an offensive game plan that allows them to be successful. And that means Carson or the receivers and tight ends, whoever you want to put the blame on. And, you know, I think, as you and I stated, it kind of got blame to go around everywhere. But you need them to come out and establish that they can pass, because we know that they're not going to run the ball. I don't know why they're not going to run the ball, but we know they're not going to. So at least, you know, at least find a way to get into a rhythm and avoid you know, falling into a deep hole and then expecting Carson Palmer to throw you out of it, because unfortunately that's worked against teams like Carolina and Tampa Bay, but, you know, it hasn't worked against teams like New Orleans and San Francisco and even a team like St. Louis, who, you know, I guess doesn't suck now. So that, you know, you have that going for us now.
For me, the keys, honestly, I really like the Cardinals with the matchup this week, especially with the history behind the kind of the history behind the Seahawks. They struggled here in Arizona. They struggle on Thursday nights. Home teams tend to have a huge advantage on the Thursday night game. The key to the game for me, and it's very fundamental, they can't turn the ball over. They win that game against San Francisco if they eliminate, I think, one of those turnovers. They take one. Definitely if they take away two, they take that game. That was just crippling, all those turnovers. You can't win any game turning the ball over four times. If they can play with the same physicality defensively, and I think that we're going to see that, and if they play with if they do everything else the same offensively except for turning the ball over, I think that's all they have to do. They're that close, in my opinion.
Well, I agree. They're very close. It's been, you know, like I said, it's been frustrating to watch because turnovers have played such a huge part in all their losses so far. You had the inexplicable interception against St. Louis. You had last week, obviously, with the interceptions and the two fumbles. So, you know, protecting the ball's, you know, good, but I'm kind of at the point where I'm expecting an interception or I'm expecting a careless fumble because we've seen it. I mean, Rashard Mendenhall fumbled the ball three times against Tampa Bay and luckily only lost one of them. So if you're going to turn the ball over, you know your defense is going to make enough plays to get you the ball back. So I want to see a sustained, like, drive. I don't know how much of the Monday night game you watched last night, but that statistic about the 4 10-plus scoring drives for the Chargers, I just imagined Ken Whisenhunt sitting over there rubbing his goatee and just kind of smiling, thinking, you know, this is all I wanted last year with the defense I had, is I just wanted to be able to sustain long drives and keep the ball out of all these other offensive hands. And that's kind of what Arians needs to do. I know he wants to be explosive, and I know he wants to attack downfield, but, you know, your offense hasn't been good enough to do that yet. So, as you said, protect the ball, hold on to the ball, don't let the other team beat you, and you'll be better. Because, you know, when they do finally put together a great offensive performance, you know, you're hoping that the defense is still able to do what they've been doing over the last 6 weeks, or, you know, over the first 6 weeks of the season, and it's not too late. So I would just like to see some sustained drives, and finish those drives, like you said. And if you do turn the ball over, come back the next time and go down the field and sustain a drive. Don't turn the ball over and then turn around and go three and out the next drive because you're trying to hit a big play and get it all back at once.
Bold prediction. Give me a real quick bold prediction for the game on Thursday.
My bold prediction is that Andre Ellington scores two touchdowns and has a huge game, and unfortunately the Cardinals fall a little short because of that. But I think Andre Ellington continues to his coming out party as one of the most underutilized offensive weapons in the NFL, and continues to kind of shine and be a bright spot for this team.
I think this is actually this is a bold prediction. This is going to be the game that Carson Palmer puts the game from start to finishing. So my bold prediction: this is the game Carson Palmer doesn't turn the ball over or limits it to one. He throws for more touchdowns than interceptions. This is bold prediction. I think the Cardinals are winning by 13. Crazy. I think it's going to happen. This is the week the Cardinals are going to bust through, finally get a signature win against their division foe.
Arizona Cardinals fans, thank you for listening. This has been Revenge of the Birds Radio. On behalf of Seth Cox, that's Seth Cox, I'm Jess Roop. Thank you for listening. We will be back next week. Have a good night.
Have a good one, Jess.
You've been listening to Revenge of the Birds. Keep the conversation going by visiting revengeofthebirds.com. Follow us on Twitter at Revenge of Birds. You can also find us on iTunes at facebook.com/Revenge of the Birds.